You're listening to the free ad-sponsored re-release of American Election's Wicked Game, a weekly march through every presidential election from 1789 to 2024. To listen to all episodes right now ad-free, go to intohistory.com. Subscribers there enjoy ad-free listening, early access, bonus content, and more from a growing collection of great history podcasts. Start your free trial today at intohistory.com. It's July 30th, 1917, in Manhattan, at a hotel on Broadway. A bellhop opens the door to a hotel room and shows two guests inside, an older, well-dressed man in his 50s and a beautiful young woman in a short, pink dress. She's closer in age to the bellhop than the older man by far, but it's really none of his business. He throws open the curtains to lighten the place and heads for the door.
Enjoy your stay, Mr. Hardwick.
That's, of course, not the well-dressed man's name. But it's the one he gave to the fellow at the front desk. Discretion is important, especially for a man in his line of work. Alone at last, the two lovers stare into each other's eyes. But they're interrupted.
Hello? No, I'm sorry. No, you've got the wrong party.
The man hangs up the phone and returns his gaze to the young woman sitting on the bed. Now, where were we? The older man takes off his hat and sets it on the bed. But just as he sits beside her, they're interrupted again. Startled, the two lovers leap to their feet. The door bursts open and two strangers rush inside. They're not police, or maybe they are, but they're dressed in plain clothes.
Sit down, both of you.
Terrified, they do as they're told.
What's your name, young lady?
She looks to the older man. What shall I say? Tell the truth. They've got us. The young woman stiffens her spine. My name is Nan Britton. Gentlemen, let the girl go, please. But the strangers are in no mood.
I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to her. How old are you?
Let the poor girl go. I can answer for both of us. She's 22.
Nan nervously interjects. I'm 20, sir.
I don't know which one of you is telling the truth. And I don't really care, because you can tell it to the judge.
Just then, the other stranger picks up the man's hat off the bed. He looks inside and sees a name stitched in gold lettering, W.G. Harding. He shows it to the other man. The two confer privately for a moment, and then suddenly the conversation's tone changes completely.
Well, we apologize for any inconvenience, Senator, but we've already called the police and they're on their way now.
At the stranger's urging, the Senator and Nan quickly gather their things, rush downstairs, and exit out a side entrance of the hotel into the busy street.
Forgive me, Senator. If we had known it was you, we wouldn't have bothered you. I'm sure.
The Senator slips the stranger a $20 bill, goes on his way. He and Nan climb inside a taxi. As the cab disappears down Broadway, Ohio Senator and future President Warren G. Harding turns to his mistress.
Well, Nan, I think we're lucky. I thought I wouldn't get out of that for under $1,000.
In the summer of 1917, Republican Senator Warren G. Harding was well-positioned to become the Republican nominee for 1920. He was a political superstar in Ohio, a key electoral state, but his personal foibles were a political liability. Nan Britton wasn't 20 years old, as she claimed. She was barely 18, and Harding was a married man and 54. A scandal like this, if unearthed, would be enough to kill anyone's political aspirations. Though he dodged a bullet this time, his multiple affairs would come back to haunt him, and to win the White House, he would engage in a cover-up. Money would change hands, silence would be bought, scandal would be suppressed, but only for a time. As is usually the case with American political scandals, the truth would come out.
Wicked Game is sponsored by NetSuite. There's that saying. That's just the cost of doing business, and it makes it sound like there's nothing you can do about certain expenses. And yeah, sure, if you run a business, there are certain things that are just going to cost what they cost. And recently, they've probably begun costing more. But not everything is just the cost of doing business. Smart companies know their numbers and can reduce their costs. One great way of doing both is switching to NetSuite, the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. And with NetSuite, you'll reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessible from anywhere. You'll cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite, and you improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math and see how you'll profit with NetSuite this year. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/elections. That's netsuite.com/elections, netsuite.com/elections. Wicked Game is sponsored by BetterHelp. I need to get something off my chest. Think about that phrase. Visualize it. The metaphor is that something is literally on your chest, weighing you down, pressing down upon you, that when you lay in bed at night, there's a heavy burden bearing down on you. And everyone has these weights, deep concerns, feelings of guilt, anger, or misery we try to keep to ourselves. But therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. And as the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. And if things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. No waiting rooms, no traffic. It couldn't be simpler. So get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/elections today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/elections. From Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Elections Wicked Game. Warren G. Harding was, to use the modern political slang, a flip-flopper. Prior to 1916, he had largely been aligned with Teddy Roosevelt and the progressive wing of the Republican Party. But when the party split in the election of 1912, Harding had sided with William Howard Taft and the conservative faction, turning his back on Teddy and the progressives. But to win the Republican nomination in 1920, Harding would have to convince members of both factions that he was not a turncoat. And he would have to convince the American people that his brand of republicanism was better than anything the Democrats had to offer, and certainly better than the failed promise of the Wilson administration. Progressive Democrat Woodrow Wilson was re-elected in 1916, largely on a promise to keep the U.S. out of international conflicts. But during his second term, much of his progressive agenda was sidelined due to the unavoidable international crisis of World War I. Wilson had indeed tried to keep America out of the conflict, but German aggression ultimately forced his hand. In February of 1917, the British intercepted a telegram from German Foreign Secretary Arthur Zimmermann to the German minister in Mexico. In it, Germany offered to help Mexico regain the lost provinces of Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona if Mexico would help Germany fight the U.S. After the Zimmermann telegram, as it came to be called, Wilson had no choice. By entering the war, Wilson was banking his presidential legacy on an Allied victory over Germany. But that was not all that was on the line. Wilson had ambitions to become the first American president to serve a third term in office. In 1920, there was yet no law prohibiting a president from seeking a third term. The 22nd Amendment, which establishes term limits, would not be ratified for another 30 years. Still, George Washington had established a two-term precedent by refusing to stand for a third term in the 1796 election. As a result, most American presidents had never seriously considered a third term. And aside from perhaps General Ulysses S. Grant, Woodrow Wilson was the first to make a concerted effort. But to win the 1920 contest, Wilson would have to first beat the Germans on the battlefield. Just after America entered the fray, things on the international stage went from bad to worse. During Wilson's second term, the world would be faced with a public health crisis that would complicate the war, threaten Wilson's future, cast a massive shadow over his presidency. In the aftermath of this unprecedented global pandemic, the Democrats would turn their back on Woodrow Wilson and look for a new leader, and the Republicans would seek to offer the American people something they truly craved, normalcy. This is episode 34, 1920, Harding versus Cox versus Debs, a return to normal.
It's Monday, March 11th, 1918, at Camp Funston, an Army training site located on Fort Riley, a military base near Manhattan, Kansas. Private Albert Gitchell, the company cook, sits on a medical cot. The last few days, he's been sweaty, sore, and achy. Earlier today, his superior sent him to the sick bay to get checked out. The medical officer on duty stands in front of Private Gitchell and places a stethoscope on his chest.
All right, deep breath in. Out. One more time. Well, the lungs sound good, but it's my throat, sir. Open up.
Medical officer shines a light into the private's throat. It's red, swollen, and inflamed.
Any other symptoms? My head is pounding.
For how long?
Since yesterday. Tried to fight through it, but it's killing me.
The duty officer puts his hand on the private's forehead.
Yeah, you're burning up. You've got a fever.
As the medical officer grabs the thermometer and places it in the private's mouth, he notices that the soldier looks uneasy. The medical officer tries to calm his nerves.
Private, I wouldn't worry. It's probably just brought on by the storm.
A few days back, Fort Riley was hit by a massive dust storm, one of the worst in recent memory. The dust was so thick the sun turned black. Trains were halted in their tracks, and the entire fort was covered in soot and sand. Soldiers like Private Gitchell had the privilege of cleaning up the mess.
Were you on cleanup duty?
Private nods yes.
Did you wear a mask?
Private shakes his head no.
Didn't they order you to wear one?
Again, the private shakes his head no.
Well, how's that? True leadership.
As the medical officer takes the thermometer out of Gitchell's mouth and checks the temperature, his eyes go wide. The private clocks his concerned expression.
How bad is it? Well, just over 40 Celsius.
That's over 104 degrees Fahrenheit. Concerned, the medical officer takes a step back and heads for the door.
Excuse me for a moment, Private. Please, stay right there.
The medical officer makes a beeline for the nurse's station. The on-duty nurse can tell from the look on the doctor's face that something is not right.
What's the matter, doctor? We need to isolate Private Gitchell. Right now.
But before the nurse has a chance to execute the medical officer's orders, two more soldiers appear with similar symptoms. By noon, over 100 soldiers had checked into the sick bay. By the end of the week, more than 500. And by the end of the month, well over 1,000. An entire hangar was converted to a hospital ward to accommodate the growing number of sick and dying soldiers. Over the course of the month, dozens would succumb to the strange, unknown disease. On March 30th, a member of the medical staff sent an urgent telegram to Army headquarters in Washington asking for help. Washington did not take action. Subsequently, the soldiers at Fort Riley would spread the disease, first to each other and then all across the world. They would arguably set in motion one of the deadliest pandemics in history, an outbreak that would ravish an already war-torn world and bring nations all across the globe to their knees. Fort Riley was ground zero for the 1918 flu pandemic, and Private Gitchell was patient zero. Though the disease likely originated in America, it came to be known as the Spanish flu, which we now know as the virus influenza A H1N1. The Spanish flu claimed tens of millions of lives, more than World War I itself, which happened simultaneous to the outbreak. The pandemic's path of destruction followed soldiers across the globe. By some estimates, as many as 500 million people worldwide were infected. At least 50 million died, nearly 700,000 in the U.S. alone. Many notable Americans contracted the virus. Raymond Chandler, Georgia O'Keeffe, Walt Disney. But perhaps the most famous American to contract the Spanish flu was Democrat President Woodrow Wilson. Wilson had been re-elected in 1916 on a promise to stay out of World War I, but German aggression had compelled America's involvement. Following an Allied victory, Wilson hoped to make good on his promise of peace by pushing for the Treaty of Versailles, which dictated peace terms between Germany and Allied forces. As part of the treaty, he hoped to establish the League of Nations, a global coalition of governments working together. Wilson hoped these measures would ensure global stability and peace for decades to come and possibly earn him a third term in the White House. Though Wilson made many trips overseas to negotiate and advocate for the treaty, his biggest obstacle to establishing the League of Nations wasn't in Europe, it was inside the Republican-controlled Senate in Washington. The man at the center of the opposition was longtime Massachusetts Senator Republican Henry Cabot Lodge, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. If Wilson wanted to get the treaty passed, he would need the Republican-controlled Senate in his corner. Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2 of the U.S. Constitution dictates that the president has the power to make treaties with the advice and consent of the Senate, plus the votes of two-thirds of its members. To get those votes, Wilson would need Lodge's support. But Republican Senator Henry Cabot Lodge and Democratic President Woodrow Wilson were like oil and water. Lodge was a conservative Republican and an isolationist. Wilson, a progressive Democrat and a blossoming internationalist. But their differences weren't just political. The animus was personal, too. 4 years earlier, Teddy Roosevelt had written Senator Lodge, "Lord, I am feeling warlike with the Wilson administration." Lodge had responded, "I do not wonder that you feel warlike. I never expected to hate anyone in politics with the hatred I feel towards Wilson." But it seemed the only thing Lodge hated more than Wilson was his League of Nations. On February 24, 1919, Wilson returned from one of his many European trips. On this particular trip, Wilson had taken his wife Edith along with him. On the journey home, they had company: Assistant Navy Secretary and future President Franklin D. Roosevelt and his wife Eleanor. Wilson told his fellow Democrat that if the United States did not go into the League of Nations, it will break the heart of the world. Wilson's ship made port in Boston Harbor, Senator Lodge's home turf, and Wilson did not come back from Europe empty-handed. He had a rough draft of the treaty in his possession. An advisor had suggested that Wilson present the treaty to Senator Lodge straight away, but Wilson ignored the advice, choosing instead to present the draft in a public speech. In Boston, Wilson was introduced to the crowd by the popular Republican governor of Massachusetts, another future president named Calvin Coolidge. Coolidge gave a flowery introduction. "We welcome him as the representative of a great people, as a great statesman." But in his speech, Wilson did not play the part of a dignified statesman. He went on the attack, railing, "Any man who resists the present tides that run in the world will find himself thrown upon a shore so high and barren that it will seem as if he had been separated from his humankind forever." Days later, Wilson invited several members of Lodge's committee to a dinner in Boston. But instead of seeking their counsel, he preached to them his gospel of Wilsonism. After the dinner, one of the committee members told the press that he felt as if I had been wandering with Alice in Wonderland and had tea with the Mad Hatter. When I awakened this morning, I expected the White Rabbit to go to breakfast with me. Henry Cabot Lodge was equally unimpressed by Wilson's impassioned plea. And so on March 3rd, Lodge made an announcement of his own. He had nearly 40 senators in his corner who wanted nothing to do with the League of Nations. Lodge had a long list of reservations. For the treaty to pass, his list would need to be addressed. One senator, James Watson of Indiana, asked Lodge, "Suppose the president accepts the treaty with your reservations?" Lodge wasn't concerned. "My dear James, you do not take into consideration the hatred that Woodrow Wilson has for me personally. Never under any set of circumstances in this world could he be induced to accept a treaty with Lodge reservations appended to it." And true enough, Wilson believed it was the president's job to make treaties. In his mind, the Senate should be nothing more than a rubber stamp. Lodge, of course, felt the opposite. He believed Congress was integral to the process, and he wasn't alone. Assistant Navy Secretary Franklin Delano Roosevelt wrote of Wilson's strategy, "Negotiating and signing a treaty and handing it cold to the Senate is all wrong. If I were doing it, I'd take the Senate, maybe the House, into my confidence as far as I could. I'd get them committed to a principle and then work out the details in negotiations. And that way, the thing could be secured." But Wilson refused to play ball with the Senate. Instead, he made multiple trips to Europe to shore up the League of Nations, hoping to force it through the Senate through an act of sheer will. But in doing so, he put himself in harm's way. The journey from the U.S. to Europe was always dangerous. Presidents typically did not leave the continental borders of the United States for any reason, much less to cross the Atlantic Ocean. And in the spring of 1919, the journey was especially dangerous because of the Spanish flu pandemic. The Spanish flu hit America hard. Churches were closed, community gatherings canceled, entire cities shut down. The pandemic had already hit Wilson close to home. His personal secretary had been infected. So too had several members of the White House staff and the Secret Service, not to mention his oldest daughter, Margaret. And it hit Wilson, too. The previous spring, while attending the Paris Peace Conference, Wilson had contracted the virus. The next day, his doctor had sent a telegram to Wilson's chief of staff back in Washington, saying the situation was extremely dire. Wilson's staff had done their best to keep his condition a secret. Slowly but surely, though, the virus took its toll, and Wilson's behavior started to change. He became increasingly erratic and nonsensical, barking illogical orders and battling strange fits of paranoia. Still, as he fought off the disease, Wilson never backed off the fight for the League of Nations. In the summer of 1919, he went before Congress and made another impassioned plea, but it largely fell on deaf ears. In August, he gathered members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at the White House. Again, instead of asking for their advice, he tried to railroad them. One committee member in particular was unmoved. At the meeting, Warren G. Harding took a firm stance against the treaty. In Harding's mind, the war was over. The League was unnecessary. Europe was Europe's problem. But if Wilson could not convince the senators, he could change the hearts and minds of the citizens who elected them. In early September 1919, Wilson would embark on an aggressive speaking tour, spanning multiple states and covering thousands of miles. He would push himself to the physical limit, and he would sacrifice his political capital, his reputation, and his health. As Wilson sought to make his case to the people, his condition would go from bad to worse. With the future of the League of Nations and a third term hanging in the balance, Woodrow Wilson would suddenly find himself a hair's breadth away from the grave.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
It's Tuesday morning, October 2nd, 1919, in the president's apartment at the White House. It's 5 a.m., and Woodrow Wilson is fast asleep, but his wife, Edith, is not. As she watches her husband sleep peacefully, her mind is racing. He barely recovered from a serious bout of influenza, but then, a few days back in Colorado, he collapsed from exhaustion in the middle of a speech. On the train ride home, his condition deteriorated. Doctors believe he may have suffered a minor stroke. Needless to say, for Edith, sleep has been hard to come by, so she's exhausted, and her eyes feel heavy. She glances at Woodrow one last time before drifting off herself. Then a few hours later, Edith awakes with a start. She sees Woodrow sitting on the edge of the bed. He reaches for a water bottle on the bedside table, but he's struggling.
Woodrow, let me help you.
I'm fine.
No, you're not fine.
Edith makes her way to the bottle and hands it to her husband. As he takes it, Edith notices that his left hand is limp.
Your hand, dear? Is there something wrong?
I don't know. I have no feeling in it.
Will you rub it?
Edith places her hand on his and tries to rub some of the life back into it, but it's clear it's not working.
I can't feel a thing.
Will you help me to the bathroom?
Of course.
With each difficult step, Woodrow seethes in pain. Edith holds him upright on his way to the bathroom, but before she gives him privacy, she asks a question she knows her husband won't like.
Can I leave you alone long enough to telephone the doctor?
Woodrow sighs in frustration. Edith knows Woodrow doesn't want a doctor. She knows he wants to get better and to get back to the fight for the League of Nations, but she also knows his condition is not improving. Woodrow knows it too. In a soft voice, he relents.
Call him.
Edith Wilson telephoned the president's doctor. In the middle of the call, she heard what she described as a slight noise coming from the apartment. She ran back to the bathroom and found her husband on the floor, unconscious, lying in a pool of his own blood. On October 2, 1919, 13 months before the 1920 election, President Wilson suffered a massive stroke. It was not his first, but it was by far the most severe. He collapsed in the bathroom, and on his way to the floor, he struck his head against the bathtub, gashing his nose and temple. He lost control over the left side of his body and most of his vision in his left eye. Rumors abounded. Many feared Wilson would not survive. Many others saw weakness and sought to capitalize on it. Just over a month after Wilson's stroke, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge proposed 14 separate reservations to the Treaty of Versailles. The key reservation was this: the United States assumes no obligation to preserve the territorial integrity of any other country or to interfere in controversies between nations. It was a direct attack on Wilson's internationalism. But Wilson was determined to put up a fight. I am a sick man, lying in this bed, but I am going to debate this issue with these gentlemen. I have breath enough in my body to carry on the fight. I shall do this even if I have to give my life to it, and I will get their political scalps when the truth is known to the people. But Lodge and the senators were not afraid. By mid-November 1919, the Senate voted to reject the treaty in its current form. By March of the next year, the treaty was officially killed, and with it, Wilson's prospects for a third term. It was the first time in American history that the Senate voted down an international treaty. Wilson's defeat, orchestrated by Senator Lodge, gave the Republicans an opening to seize presidential power in the upcoming election. Party leaders would turn to a senator who had played a key role in defeating Wilsonism, Warren G. Harding. But before Harding could win his party's nomination, he would first have to deal with a personal scandal with potential enough to derail his presidential prospects. Nan Britton, the young woman in the pink dress in the New York hotel, was not the only secret Harding was keeping from his wife Florence, or the American people. In April of 1920, 2 months before the Republican convention, Harding received a letter from a scorned lover named Carrie Fulton Phillips, whom he had met back in Marion during his days as an Ohio newspaperman. Harding had tried to end things with her, but Phillips didn't go quietly. In her letter, she threatened to blackmail him. Harding wrote Phillips back with an offer. $20,000 in hush money, $250,000 in today's dollars. Phillips got something else out of the deal, too, an all-expense-paid trip overseas for her and her husband. All she had to do was keep her mouth shut and stay out of the country until after the election. Phillips agreed. Harding had dodged yet another bullet, but his wife Florence would eventually learn the truth. However betrayed she must have felt, though, Florence still tried to keep her husband's secret. Years later, or so the story goes, Florence would burn many of her husband's private correspondences to try to protect his legacy, but in the long term, it wouldn't be enough to keep the truth under wraps. But in the short term, the hush money payments worked. Going into the convention, Harding's path to the nomination was clear of scandal. What appeared to be the biggest obstacle to Warren Harding's nomination was Warren Harding. Not everyone was a fan of the man. After his keynote speech at the 1916 Republican convention, the New York Times had written, "His full name is Warren G. Harding, and he is a senator from Ohio. But it is not necessary to burden one's memory with these statistics if one is merely trying to remember the names of persons likely to be president." Even Harding had his doubts. After announcing his intention to run back in December of 1919, Harding had written a friend, "The only thing I really worry about is that I am sometimes very much afraid I'm going to be nominated and elected. That's an awful thing to contemplate." At the Republican convention in Chicago in 1920, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge made the keynote address. In it, he railed against Wilson, saying, "In 1916, Mr. Wilson won on the cry that he had kept us out of war. He now demands the approval of the American people for his party and his administration on the ground that he has kept us out of peace." To raucous applause, Lodge exclaimed, "I am not compromising. I am against this league. There are no reservations that can cure its wickedness." Republicans agreed that defeating Wilson's internationalism was priority number one, but the question of picking a nominee was more complicated. Early ballots produced a deadlock between two candidates, one progressive, one conservative. The old split in the party persisted. But dark horse candidate Warren G. Harding had, at one point in time, been both. Though Harding's detractors would point to his political evolution as evidence that he lacked principles, his supporters would see it as an advantage. Harding had been both progressive and conservative. He knew how to appeal to both factions. In addition, Harding's campaign manager had a plan. Prior to the convention, his manager had said, "I don't expect Senator Harding to be nominated on the first, second, or third ballots, but I think we can afford to take chances that about 11 minutes after 2, Friday morning of the convention, when 15 weary men are sitting around a table, someone will say, 'Who will we nominate?' At that decisive time, the friends of Harding will suggest him." The manager's prediction came true, in no small part because Senator Henry Cabot Lodge flexed his muscles. Late on a Friday night at the Blackstone Hotel in room 404, Lodge made his case for Harding to a group of powerful party leaders. "There aren't any first-raters this year. We haven't any. We haven't any Theodore Roosevelts. We've got a lot of second-raters, and Warren Harding is the best of the second-raters." It was hardly a resounding endorsement, but Lodge's support helped push Harding over the line. Harding secured the nomination on the 10th ballot. For his running mate, Republicans nominated a man of few words, but who was mighty in his actions, Massachusetts Governor Calvin Coolidge. Coolidge had gained renown for taking a hard stance against a labor strike in Boston. He had forcibly ended the strike, famously saying, "There is no right to strike against the public safety by anybody, anywhere, anytime." Coolidge had a reputation as an honest, moral man. He was a strong supporter of the controversial 18th Amendment, which outlawed alcohol. Coolidge would make a strong contrast to Warren G. Harding, an unfaithful husband who rarely turned down a drink. But Harding was, in many ways, a strong candidate. A man of few political convictions, he could be easily molded by party leaders. He was handsome, dapper, and lean, a near-picture-perfect candidate whose promise to the American people was summed up best by his hopeful campaign slogan, "A Return to Normalcy." As the Republicans rallied behind the Harding-Coolidge ticket, the Democrats geared up for their 1920 convention. There, party leaders would officially turn their back on President Wilson. In the wake of World War I, Wilson had banked his hopes for a third term on the League of Nations, a post-war global coalition. His hopes had been dashed by his failure to gain Senate support for the League, specifically the Treaty of Versailles, a post-war treaty between the victorious Allies and a defeated Germany. At the Democratic National Convention in San Francisco, the first ever national convention on the West Coast, the party adopted a pro-League of Nations platform. But they abandoned Wilson and instead rallied around a relatively inconsequential candidate, former Congressman and Ohio Governor James M. Cox. Cox, like Harding, had been a small-town newspaper man before getting into politics. He had accomplished little, but Democrats believed they needed an Ohio man to win the election. After all, President Wilson had won his home state in 1912 and 1916, and in 1920, Ohio Senator Warren Harding looked poised to take back the Buckeye State for the Republicans. Democrats felt Cox's Ohio roots might block Harding's path to victory. Cox's running mate, on the other hand, would prove to be very consequential. For their vice presidential nominee, Democrats selected Assistant Navy Secretary Franklin D. Roosevelt, widely known by his initials FDR. Though he had little political experience on the national level, FDR had a famous last name, and he was a distant cousin of the late Teddy Roosevelt. FDR's fame, though, was not enough to overcome Cox's shortcomings. In addition to being an uninspiring candidate, Cox had a skeleton in his closet. Over a decade before the 1920 contest, Cox's wife had divorced him for cruelty and neglect. Despite his best efforts, Cox had been unable to keep the scandal out of the public eye. One Ohio newspaper had written, "The marital troubles of Mr. and Mrs. Cox have been no secret. The separation came just about the time Cox was elected to Congress. Mrs. Cox charges that for a year preceding the separation in April 1909, Cox scarcely spoke to her, almost completely ignoring her for a month at a time." So on the campaign trail, it was easy for Republicans to attack Cox's character in the press. Republicans also pointed to Cox's wetness or his opposition to prohibition as further evidence that Cox was a man of loose morals. This damaged Cox in the dry South, where support for the 18th Amendment was widespread. And Cox did little to defend himself, and even less on the campaign trail. Prior to the convention, Cox had written, "My friends are urging me to open up a vigorous campaign." But Cox preferred to take a back seat. "We either have an ace in the hole or we haven't. If we have an ace concealed, we win. If we haven't, no amount of bluffing and advertising can do much good." Cox and the Democrats were not holding any aces. In the 1920s, there was a popular saying in American politics, "As Maine goes, so goes the nation." Maine's state and local elections were held early, usually in September. Maine's vote was often a portent of what was to come in the presidential election. And in September of 1920, Republicans swept the Maine governor's race, winning every county. They won over 90% of the state house, 100% of the state senate, and all four of the congressional seats. All signs pointed to a Harding victory, including national polls, a relatively new invention in American politics. Polls in the Boston Globe and the New York World projected a Harding victory. But one Democrat in Ohio was determined to prove the pollsters wrong. In the final stretch of the campaign, a man with a personal vendetta would start digging for scandals. He would unearth dirt on Republican candidate Warren G. Harding, and he would use it to smear Harding's reputation and hopefully hand the White House to James M. Cox.
Tom!
Tired of ads and promos like these? Want to skip ahead to newer elections? You can listen to all episodes of American Elections Wiki Game without interruption by subscribing at intohistory.com. But not only that, you also get access to over a dozen more incredible history podcasts, also all ad-free. That includes the American Revolution podcast, a deep and thorough investigation of the times, people, and politics behind America's fight for independence. Also, the battles, because we can't start a new American nation without guns. And the American Revolution podcast tells the story of the revolution from beginning to end, from its origins in the French and Indian War, through the war itself, and on to the founding of the United States. Get American Elections Wicked Game, the American Revolutions podcast, and many others ad-free with bonus content at intohistory.com. Subscribe now at intohistory.com. Did you know you can skip ads and promos like these and listen to all episodes of American Elections Wiki Game without interruption by subscribing at intohistory.com? And not only will you be getting the whole series ad-free and bingeable, but you also get access to over a dozen more incredible history podcasts, also ad-free, like Her Half of History. Because even though Hillary Clinton may not have made history when she ran for president in 2016, there have always been women who seized power, spied for their country, created artistic masterpieces, even escaped slavery. Her Half of History is perfect for all those who sat in history class and wondered, what were the women doing all this time? Because the answer is a lot. Get Her Half of History, Wicked Game, and many others ad-free at intohistory.com. Subscribe now at intohistory.com. Democrat William Estabrook Chancellor, like Warren Harding, was an Ohio man. He was an academic, a writer, and a man with political ambitions. A former Democratic elector who had made a failed run at Congress, Chancellor was a city councilman and a professor in Worcester, Ohio. He was also an extreme racist, even by the standards of his time. He had a criminal record, and he had been previously fired from a job for stirring up racial tensions. His former boss called him an erratic man with wild ideas. In June of 1920, Chancellor had heard a rumor that disturbed him. Warren G. Harding had Negro blood in his veins. After Harding's victory at the Republican convention, Chancellor had one of his infamous wild ideas. The prospect of a Negro president was too much for him to bear, so Chancellor went looking for evidence. He found it, or so he claimed. Chancellor alleged that Harding was an octoroon, meaning he was 1/8 black. Chancellor claimed he interviewed hundreds of witnesses who had verified this fact, though only 4 of them were willing to swear an affidavit. Just weeks before the election, Chancellor published his findings in 2 pamphlets, The Harding Family Tree and To the Men and Women of America, an Open Letter. Thousands of copies were printed and distributed all across the country. The press latched onto the story. It was published in most major publications, from the Chicago Tribune to the Washington Post. But the substance of the reporting varied. Some papers were reluctant to run the story at all. Some acknowledged that there was a whisper campaign against Harding, but they did not report on the particulars. Other papers ran the story as cold fact. But the New York Call, a de facto bullhorn for the Socialist Party of America, had a different take. Both parties do regard the possession of Negro blood by any man seeking office to be as unfitting him for public office. But they dare not say this openly. There are millions of Negro votes to be cast. So they keep the real story from the voting masses and give the impression that the charges against Harding reflect upon his private life and character. Still, many were skeptical that the story was true at all, and many found it odd that all the reporting on the story could be traced back to one man, William Estabrook Chancellor. Chancellor publicly denied that he wrote the pamphlets. Concerned, Worcester College officials asked Professor Chancellor to release a public statement affirming the Hardings were white, but Chancellor refused, releasing this statement instead. As to the Harding ancestry, I hereby certify I am in no way responsible for, never wrote, never authorized to write, and know nothing whatever about the circulars bearing my name or any other paper. It didn't work. Not long after, Chancellor was fired from Worcester College. But the damage had already been done. In the final stretch of the campaign, the Chancellor pamphlets caught on like wildfire. GOP officials tried to control the damage, but their forceful denials in the press only fueled the rumors. When a reporter asked Warren G. Harding point blank, "Do you have Negro blood?" Harding responded, "How do I know, Jim? One of my ancestors may have jumped the fence." But in late October, Harding went on a press tour in Ohio to try and put the rumors to bed. He was clearly angry. As one supporter described it, one morning Harding wanted to go over to Worcester and beat Chancellor up. It took some little time to get him to cool off. and while Harding was restrained from doing anything, in Marion, Ohio, just one day before the presidential election, one member of the Harding family would take matters into his own hands. It's Monday, November 1st, 1920, outside a local cigar shop in Marion, Ohio. It's the day before the election, and tensions are running high, especially for Dr. George Harding, father of Republican candidate Warren G. Harding. George is sick and tired of the whisper campaign being conducted against his family in the press. And as George marches up to the front of the cigar store in a huff, he sees just the man he's been looking for.
Judge Spencer!
That's probate judge William S. Spencer, a supporter of Democratic candidate James M. Cox. At the sound of his name, Judge Spencer turns to find an irate George Harding bearing down on him.
Mr. Harding, what can I do for you, sir? I have it on good authority you've been circulating these vicious rumors against my family. I'm sorry, I've done no such thing, Mr. Harding. By God, I say you have.
A crowd starts to form around the two men. Among them, a young farmhand named Herman. Herman is a Democrat, but he's one of George's close friends. He watches as George inches closer to the judge.
Do you deny it, sir? I swear on my honor as a gentleman. Your honor won't stop me from smashing you in the face. I've done nothing wrong, Mr. Harding. I'm willing to swear out an affidavit saying as much.
But just then, Herman shouts from the crowd.
Don't believe him, George! I've heard the judge repeat those stories with my own ears.
Spencer turns to Herman.
You're a liar!
Herman clenches his fist and cracks Judge Spencer across the jaw. The judge hits the ground with a thud. He's out cold. The crowd is riled up.
Hit him again! Hit him again!
But as Herman lunges for the judge, George shoves his friend back.
Ah, that's enough.
The crowd restrains Herman as George looks down at Judge Spencer. Spencer is old. He has a peg leg, and now he's badly hurt. George is livid, but he takes pity on the judge. George helps him to his feet and leads the judge back to his office in the nearby courthouse. There, Judge Spencer makes good on his word. He swears out an affidavit, denying his involvement in the whisper campaign. Despite Chancellor's best efforts, the Harding campaign not only survived the scandal, it thrived. On Election Day in 1920, Warren G. Harding became the first sitting U.S. Senator to take the White House. Harding won 37 states and more than 60% of the popular vote, double Cox's numbers. Harding had even done well in the South, becoming the first Republican candidate to win Tennessee since Ulysses S. Grant. Harding won 404 electoral votes to Cox's 127. At the time, it was the largest margin of victory in the history of presidential elections. The GOP fared nearly as well. They maintained majorities in both houses. Shortly after the election, Henry Cabot Lodge gloated, "We have won the fight. We have destroyed Mr. Wilson's League of Nations. We have torn up Wilsonism by the roots." Warren G. Harding must have felt like celebrating. The day after the election, Secret Service agents arranged for Nan Britton to meet the president at a campaign house near Harding's home in Marion. Nan would write of their rendezvous, "After affectionate greetings, I exclaimed softly, 'Oh, sweetheart, isn't it wonderful that you are president?' He held me close, kissing me over and over again. He looked at me some time before he answered, 'This is the best thing that's happened to me lately, dearie.'" Though Harding had succeeded in buying the silence of Carrie Fulton Phillips, the truth about Harding's affairs would eventually come out. Years after the 1920 election, Nan Britton would publish what is arguably the first modern exposé in American politics. Her kiss-and-tell account of her affair with Harding would forever damage his reputation. But Nan's book wasn't the only impact women made on American politics in the 1920s. The 1920 contest was not strictly a two-way race. Socialist Party candidate and political activist Eugene Victor Debs was on the ballot as well. Debs had run for president many times before. In 1900, he had earned just under 100,000 votes nationwide. In 1904 and 1908, he had won four times that amount in each showing. In 1912, his fourth presidential run, he had done even better. Debs' fiery speeches against America's involvement in World War I had made him an enemy of President Wilson, who called Debs a traitor. In June of 1918, Debs had made a speech in Ohio calling for citizens to resist the military draft. Shortly after, he had been arrested, charged and convicted of multiple counts of sedition, earning him 10 years in prison. But that didn't stop the Socialist Party from rallying behind their founder. In May of 1920, at the Socialist National Convention, party leaders had nominated Debs once again for the fifth time. Though he didn't make a massive impact on the outcome of the election, In the 1920 contest, he made his strongest showing yet, over 900,000 votes. One of the reasons Debs performed so well is because he benefited from a massive shift in the voting landscape that had occurred in the summer of 1920, the ratification of the 19th Amendment. The decades-long struggle that had started in 1848 at the first Women's Rights Convention culminated in 1920 when women cast votes for the first time. While most women voted Republican, many female voters cast their ballots for Eugene Debs. He had been a longtime supporter of women's rights, and in the 1920 contest, many suffragists thanked him at the polls. The 1920 election also marked the official end of the progressive era. But progressivism was anything but dead, even if many of its champions were. President Teddy Roosevelt had died in January of 1919. In the decade that followed, many more progressive icons would pass on, including President Woodrow Wilson. Eugene Debs, too, would pass away before the decade was out. Still, the ideas of the progressive movement would live on. America's progressives would leave an indelible mark on history and make a massive impact on the outcome of the upcoming election in 1924. This is episode 34 of American Elections Wicked Game, 1920, A Return to Normal. On the next episode, the election of 1924. In the aftermath of President Harding's death, Calvin Coolidge is sworn in as America's 30th president. To shed the label of accidental president, Coolidge will have to out-campaign a bitterly divided but highly motivated Democratic Party, but gets help from an unlikely place, the newly reborn Progressive Party. Icebergs, jagged rocks and rocky straits, mutinies, misfortune, and broadside battles. There are more tales of the sea than survivors to tell them. But the podcast Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is doing a good job, and you can listen to all episodes of that podcast, plus many others, including American Elections Wicked Game, without interruption by subscribing at intohistory.com. Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is one of my favorites from last year, a podcast about the greatest mishaps, misfortune, and misadventures of the sea. You'll hear stories of corruption, greed, bad intentions, and just plain horrible decision-making that resulted in some of the worst maritime disasters from all over the world. And some of these are more recent than you think. All episodes are ad-free, including bonus content and more, at intohistory.com. Subscribe now at intohistory.com. This episode contains reenactments and dramatized details. And while in most cases we can't know exactly what was said, all our dramatizations are based on historical research. American Elections Wicked Game is an Airship production. Hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. Co-executive produced by Stephen Walters in association with Ritual Productions. Written and researched by Stephen Walters. Fact-checking by Greg Jackson and C.L. Salazar from the podcast History That Doesn't Suck.